Hi, this is Newt. Due to the virus, I'm recording from home, so you may notice a difference in audio quality. Well, in this episode of Newt's World, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo completely mishandled the early days of the pandemic and the virus entering our country. He made misguided policy decisions that killed thousands, including many seniors. I've been talking about how his actions have impacted thousands of New York citizens for months. Just this week, the New York Times published, quote, 9 top New York health officials have quit as Cuomo scorns expertise, close quote. Governor Cuomo's mishandling of the pandemic has been further called into question after State Attorney General Letitia James said his administration had undercounted the number of COVID-19 deaths in nursing home residents by not publicly disclosing deaths of those residents that occurred in hospitals. In fact, New York is one of the hardest hit states in the nation, with over 1.42 million cases. It's 1,420,000 cases and 43,178 deaths. My guest has a new book out about Cuomo and Mayor de Blasio, Matt Palumbo. Matt Palumbo, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me on. It's a great pleasure.
Now, your new book, I must say, I like the title, Dumb and Dumber, How Cuomo and de Blasio Ruined New York. You wrote, quote, if New York were its own country, it would have more coronavirus deaths per capita than any other in the entire world. Mm-hmm. Why did this happen?
It was really a comedy of errors from the start. There was this huge liberal narrative that Trump was downplaying the risks of the virus. And it's certainly true that he wasn't publicly alarmist with it. But the only people downplaying the pandemic or future pandemic were people like de Blasio and Cuomo. Trump early on banned travel from China. And that was all happening as Democrats were fixated on impeachment. We're not even paying attention to the virus. Early on, people like de Blasio and Cuomo were really just denying that it was going to ever turn into something, was telling people, you know, keep going on with life as usual. And it got to the point where they sort of injected social justice into it, where health officials were saying, you know, the virus could be bad, but it's not going to be as bad as anti-Asian racism that might emerge. So go to Chinatown and spend money there and congregate. And they were just kind of encouraging all these things you would not want to do when a virus is about to hit your city. And then in New York as a whole, and this is really where things went off the rails, Cuomo's nursing home scandal is primarily responsible for why the state's death toll is what it was. Now, there were all these concerns early on based on various models on what hospital utilization would be like, and there's a lot of concerns that hospitals would become overwhelmed from the virus. So in response to that, Cuomo signed an order, it's called the March 25th order, and that sent people who had been previously tested positive for coronavirus but were at least a few days into their symptoms or into hospitalization, they would be sent to nursing homes. Now, and this is completely insane, New York was the only state in the nation that prohibited testing these people when they went to nursing homes. So we had no way of knowing if they were still infectious. And well, we do know now that obviously they were. Within just a few months, about 2 months, there would be 6,000 people in nursing homes were reported dead. And that was just reported according to what they were telling us. I argued in the book it was close to 12,000. And the reason why is if you contracted coronavirus in a nursing home and then were transported back to a hospital as an elderly person, your death was a hospital death, not a nursing home death. And then now we have that new AG report basically confirming that, yes, they were understated to that exact extent. And Cuomo's defenses have just sort of been laughable since then. So he had the New York Health Department commission their own study exonerating themselves, and they were trying to claim, no, it wasn't our policy. It was they got it from the nurses. So I started speaking to nurses who worked in these nursing homes, and they said, no, we were tested going in, so we couldn't have spread it. We obviously got it from the coronavirus patients they were sending us, and then it spread from there. Also interesting, that study was sponsored by McKinsey, which Cuomo himself relied on for those extrapolations on how overwhelmed hospitals would get. So there's sort of a conflict of interest within the conflict of interest. And now Cuomo's pivoted even from there into just kind of denying that there ever was a nursing home scandal and saying, you know, we didn't need this space. We have the 10 hospitals and the USNS Comfort that Trump sent. So why would we have even needed that policy? So we've kind of gone through everything from this disaster to Cuomo trying to get his own department to cover for him to just outright denying that this happened. And then for the most part, the media does seem to have let him get away from it, though hopefully this AG report changes that.
So I'm curious, what was the rationale for not testing?
Well, that's the thing I can't figure out. It makes no sense at all. And, you know, Cuomo himself tried to blame Trump for the nursing home scandal and said, well, it was actually CDC guidance that got in our policy to free up space. But the CDC explicitly said you'd have to test these people. It's, you know, one of those questions I can't answer because I don't think there really is a rational answer. It was just, you know, very sloppily designed, this plan.
Well, I did a podcast a couple of months ago with Betsy McCoy, the former lieutenant governor of New York. She thought all this was deeply involved in Cuomo's relationship with the New York Hospital Association and their top lobbyist, and that the hospitals really did not want people with COVID in the hospitals and dramatically preferred dumping them on nursing homes. I don't know if that's true or not, but McCoy deeply believed that this all went back to sort of local politics.
What's depressing is we know that the people in charge of these sort of policies knew what the result would be. Our new, was an HHS secretary that Biden just appointed, took her mother out of a nursing home before putting this kind of policy into effect. There was one county in New York, I think it was Rensselaer County, where, you know, a Republican runs the county. He said this nursing home order is insane. He was the only person that defined it. The only nursing home in his county had no coronavirus deaths. So it's very clear that, you know, this was what was responsible for it.
I was looking at something you highlight in your book on the difference between New York City and San Francisco, and that they're sort of both very densely populated. But I then went out and did my own research. New York City has 10 times the population of San Francisco. Mm-hmm. But San Francisco had 324 deaths. New York City had 27,138. So if they've been proportionate, New York should have had 3,240.
Yep.
So there are an extra 24,000 deaths in New York City compared to San Francisco. How could there be such a gigantic difference in COVID impact in the two cities?
Yeah, well, they just took action first. And, you know, I'm not going to pretend that everything's A-OK in San Francisco. I mean, a lot of their small businesses are suffering just as much as in New York. But, you know, at least they don't have the COVID death toll along with that. And it really just came down to taking action early. They started doing mass testing very early. They started banning very large gatherings. And, like, you know, obviously I'm not pro very strict lockdown, but I don't think it's that unreasonable to start banning mass gatherings. And they were way ahead of the curve on that. And just all these other just, you know, precautionary measures they took ahead of time, as opposed to saying, go out and congregate and, you know, fight racism by exposing yourself to a virus. But, you know, it shows up in the numbers.
When you compare Governor Cuomo and Mayor de Blasio, how would you compare their relative impact?
If you look at the deaths per capita, they are much higher in the city than in the state. So, you know, naturally, I would say de Blasio did a worse job. Obviously, the nursing home contributed to de Blasio's death count as well. So it's hard to say. I think de Blasio was probably worse. He was more actively promoting things that were harmful, I would say.
He was sort of rejecting the reality of the virus longer than Cuomo did.
Correct. Yeah, it got to the point where many of his advisors had to threaten to resign to get him to take action on certain things. And, you know, he never really led by example either, which I know we can't really expect from our politicians. Like, he banned going to the gym, and the last thing he did on that day was go to the gym. So he just didn't really send much of a message, nor did his health department even seem to really be that focused on where you'd want to fight the virus. So, for instance, there were massive outbreaks with the New York Police Department. The health official that encouraged people to, like, congregate in Chinatown refused to distribute masks to the police when they requested them and made some derogatory comment about police. Now, you know, regardless of your opinion on masks, she is someone who does believe they work and did, despite that, explicitly refuse to give them to cops. And, you know, I'm not saying that's correlated with why there was an explosion in cases, but it just shows that, you know, they were neglecting key demographics of people for political purposes that were disproportionately exposed to this virus.
When you look at that whole experience, it seemed to me that Cuomo in particular got amazingly positive coverage from the news media, despite reality.
Well, that's sort of what the motivation for this book was. At the beginning of the coronavirus, I was in the position of everyone of just kind of accepting, well, I know nothing about this, but Cuomo's the one getting all the praise. So I went, well, let's see what this guy's doing, if he's figured it out. And it turns out he's figured nothing out. As they were praising Cuomo, everyone was ragging on Sweden, which, you know, very famously you know, didn't have any official lockdowns. The government gave guidance on things to do, but nothing was really strictly enforced. And, you know, I don't really defend their model, but I just noticed that, like, despite what the death rates in Sweden were, I'm going, well, at the same time, they're way higher in New York. So how is it the media in the same publication will attack Sweden but give Cuomo a pass when you would have been safer in Sweden the whole time? And then it was just kind of unraveling from there, everything that went wrong, you know, of which there was many. And I think Cuomo's approval, actually, in the book I quoted, it's like 84%. So everyone is buying the narrative, and it's complete nonsense.
No, it was amazing to me that, you know, Cuomo could do things that were literally killing people, and somehow the New York media would heap praise on him. Now, it does seem to me that as Trump sort of becomes less central to the national dialogue, the media is suddenly much more aggressive about going after Cuomo. And in that sense, he may be at the beginning of a period of really serious investigative reporting.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of coronavirus narrative shifts since Trump left office. I mean, I think it was just within like the week prior to Biden taking office and the weeks that followed, every mayor just suddenly went, yeah, I guess bars and restaurants should be open. And I guess schools should be open after all. And the timing, of course, is too obvious to be a coincidence, I think.
How much damage did the Cuomo strategy do to small businesses in New York?
I think it's like close to at least 30 or 40% of small businesses closures are probably permanent, because at the time of these lockdowns, most restaurants only had about a month or two of cash to burn before running out. And I've noticed in my own neighborhood, there are some businesses that are closing and then getting replaced by other businesses, but it's not the same. It's a small business getting replaced by, you know, a big business. I don't know. I don't really think it's a trend we want to see, but it's one we're seeing play out nationwide. We're seeing the stock market soar to record highs in the midst of this pandemic. And a large part of the reason is that its big businesses are composed of a disproportionate portion of these stock indexes, and they're the ones getting pushed up at the expense of everyone else. I think it's the saddest trend we've seen from this pandemic, obviously, in addition to the deaths.
Now, you focus in your book on New York City and New York State. Since you live in New Jersey, I have to ask you, I mean, hasn't New Jersey had almost a parallel bad experience?
Yeah, it's worse, actually. We have a very similar nursing home policy. I mean, they at least tested people, but it has pretty much been like that as well. And, you know, the proximity to New York probably didn't help as well with that.
Because the governor of New Jersey never gets the level of publicity that the mayor and the governor of New York do. Do you think that Cuomo will eventually take responsibility for his actions, or how does he ride this out?
Well, the thing is, he doesn't really need to. I mean, I don't need to tell you that the media works the Democratic Party, and that's what we're seeing. There was one comment the other day he made that would have sunk any other politician, and he was talking about the nursing home scandal and tried to make the point that if you die, it doesn't matter how you died. So he said something like, yeah, people died in nursing homes. Who cares? People die. And I sort of understand what he was attempting to say, but the phrasing was just so terrible that if Trump made that comment, that would stick to him for months, or any other politician, really, especially if they're a Republican, and yet he gets away with it. And even with this nursing home scandal, I mean, we haven't seen any consequences so far, and we really have known the death toll is what that AG report said since at least July or August. So I don't know. It's just very hard for me to be optimistic to see consequences.
I think it's a sobering part of what's happening in the country that disasters can occur and somehow nobody is ever held accountable, unless maybe it's Trump. But otherwise, they somehow are vaccinated against any kind of consequence for their behavior.
And speaking of vaccines, you know, he's also had some trouble with the rollout. And recently his defense was, well, we're just not getting enough vaccines for the federal government to roll them out. But weeks prior to that, he was complaining that they're not getting it to enough people in general. So he actually expanded their criteria for vaccination. So he, you know, within just a few weeks, contradicted himself on the reason why. And as it actually has to do with why all those people started leaving in droves, those 9 health officials, was a lot of counties have their own vaccine distribution plans. And Cuomo decided, well, I'm going to kind of ignore the experts and try to come up with my own. So he hired Deloitte to try to create a plan for him, which is obviously very unpopular among those who are resigning.
There actually had been a pandemic plan, which I think was developed before Cuomo even became governor, but New York didn't follow it.
Yeah, I brought that up because there was this whole narrative that Trump shredded Obama's pandemic plan, and they were kind of going blind with coronavirus. So I was looking into that history, and well, they actually replaced Obama's with one that was specific to an influenza coming from China. So, you know, obviously a coincidence that the report was that specific to something, an influenza coming from China, but they were way more prepared than Cuomo was. In fact, and I quote in the book, many people related to Cuomo didn't even know this plan existed. So not only was there a plan, they didn't use it, many people didn't even know it existed.
I mean, we moved a Navy hospital ship to New York, built out the Javits Center to 1,000 beds, and put in 3 Army field hospitals. Now, I think the total use of the Navy hospital was like 90 people or something. There was never an actual shortage of hospital space in New York. Am I wrong?
You're right, and there's also regulations that made it pretty much impossible to actually use the ship. The regulations were they couldn't accept patients directly. They had to be referred from a hospital. Ambulances couldn't bring anyone directly to the ship. So, you know, the 2/3 of the ways you'd get accepted there to be treated weren't possible. And then there was also, you know, a comedy of errors there. Initially, this ship was supposed to be exclusively for non-coronavirus patients. Turns out, with a few days of arriving, one of the people who was on the ship when it got there caught coronavirus, so that was a disaster. Then after a few days, they changed it and repurposed the ship specifically for coronavirus patients. So there was just no plan, and why those regulations were not just waived with a stroke of the pen is a mystery.
Were they federal regs?
I believe it was federal, but yeah, I don't know why there was no plan there as well. Yeah,
that's right. I mean, there is a point where common sense should win. Kind of amazing.
Yeah, I don't know why he wouldn't have just said, because, you know, it's not like Trump is aware of every federal regulation in the books. I don't know why he wouldn't have reached out and said, hey, thanks for the free hospital, but we can't use it for this reason. Please do X, Y, and Z.
So if you had to sum it up, what is it you wish the average citizen of New York and New York City would get from the way you've approached this and from your better understanding of what actually happened?
I just want it to be a kind of a wake up to the media's narrative versus reality. I think the media has the effect of sort of putting horse blinders on us and making us only see a narrative they want to see. And that sort of seems to be their purpose. And I just kind of want to wake more people up and saying, you know, the fact that every single person is singing this guy's praises and giving him Emmys doesn't actually mean anything. It really just means he's a Democrat and fortunate enough to be one.
In terms of the media bias, one of the most amazing things was Cuomo getting an International Emmy Founders Award in November 2020, quote, in recognition of his leadership during the COVID pandemic and his masterful use of television to inform and calm people. Why on earth would they have given him an Emmy given the disaster that New York State was?
I almost think it's to provide cover. So if anyone criticizes him, he can say, well, no, I got an Emmy for it. If you were to plot coronavirus cases on a chart in New York, the day he received the Emmy is when it starts to really start taking off. So the timing really couldn't have even been worse on that.
Huh. It just strikes me that the level of arrogance of giving an Emmy to a guy who was a disaster, it either tells you about the bias or the lack of common sense of the news media. I'm not sure which is more relevant.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, the thing is, it's really not hard to check these facts. I mean, it only takes a few Google searches to just see what is their coronavirus death rate, what's the national average, and then work from there. I have to believe that they're knowingly doing it.
You know, in your book, you go beyond just the health crisis, and you talk about how both de Blasio and Cuomo have really crippled New York economically and in law and order. I mean, what are the policies that have really begun hurting New York residents? And frankly, leading to a remarkable migration out of New York to other states.
And the thing about this chapter is it really could be applied to California or New Jersey or Illinois or other blue states as well. It's not necessarily specific to them in particular. They've just kind of jumped in front of the train and continued all these liberal policies that have been inflating the cost of living, raising property taxes, killing jobs, just general liberal policies. The size of their government has gotten to the point where it's about double the size of Florida's. And I mentioned Florida because they're the number one state people are fleeing New York to leave to. So I do a little comparison between New York and Florida, and I say, well, you know, are they really getting a bang for their buck for paying for a government that's twice as large? So I just go through, you know, what's the cost of living? What's the poverty rate after you adjust for the cost of living? What are the school systems like? What's the average home size someone can afford to live in? And just all these other variables in your quality of living. And they're usually either better or close enough to New York to be not that much distinguishable. So why pay double when you could pay half as much for basically the same? And that's sort of the gist of that chapter.
Do you think this has been a permanent shift in the balance of decisions towards leaving rather than staying? Or is it temporary?
I remember I was reading something in Heritage. They were estimating that about 1,000 people a day leave from blue states to red states. And that's on net balance. So, you know, accounting for migration from the opposite. I don't know if it's accelerated since then, to what extent, but the trend has continued every single year since then. You know, ironically, though, if these people do keep their politics, it does risk turning many of these red states blue. And then where do you go from there? That is sort of the only concern I have about it.
But it does weaken the blue states. I mean, their tax base decays.
And I think it's going to cause a negative feedback loop where they raise taxes further and more people leave and, you know, so on and so forth.
It's remarkable. Cuomo's already said he's going to run again for re-election. Do you think all of this affects him at all? Or given the nature of the New York machine, is he just invulnerable?
Well, with his approval rating as it is now, it does seem unlikely he would lose. But obviously, it would have to be another Democrat to run against him to have a chance, kind of, you know, in New York's current climate. Which obviously is a tragedy of politics and the media that this is even possible. Trump could do something that was literally a continuation of an Obama-era policy, and he would get portrayed as Hitler, while Cuomo can send coronavirus patients into nursing homes, and it's for the most part ignored. We are seeing intention now with the AG report, but I wouldn't be surprised if it doesn't last that long.
Yeah, it'll be interesting because other than the New York Post, there's no natural opponent to Cuomo in the media.
Correct.
Although I was very surprised by how tough the New York Times was on the resignation of these 9 public health officials.
I did find coverage of that, like in mainstream liberal publications, criticize them. It's just the ratio of positive to negative. You know, there'd be 10 positive for every 1 negative, and they can say we are covering the negative. It's just the perception of it is going to be way more positive for people reading.
Yeah, that's remarkable. Well, I think you've made a significant contribution to our understanding of what's happening in New York. I'm like you. I think a lot of you can then take that in different kinds of ways. It helps explain Illinois and New Jersey and Connecticut and California, where we're drifting the same way. But I really appreciate it. And I think that your new book, Dumb and Dumber, How Cuomo and de Blasio Ruined New York, is really a contribution to the national dialogue. And I commend you for taking the time and focusing and getting that done.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it was really an honor to be on. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you to my guest, Matt Palumbo. You can read an excerpt of his new book, Dumb and Dumber, How Cuomo and de Blasio Ruined New York, on our show page at newsworld.com.
Hello and welcome to The Bookmonger. I'm John J. Miller of National Review. Thanks for listening. This show is a production of National Review, and we're recording from the studio of WRFH, the campus radio station of Hillsdale College. This episode is sponsored by Babbel, the language learning app, and I'll tell you about that shortly. Our guest is Andy Ngo, author of Unmasked, Inside Antifa's Radical Plan to Destroy Democracy. Andy, welcome to The Bookmonger.
Thank you for having me on.
How did you get involved in covering Antifa as a journalist, and why did you want to write a book about Antifa?
So it started back in the days when I was just a student journalist at Portland State University working on a graduate program, and I was on assignment to cover the reaction to the news that Donald Trump had won in November 2016. And the reaction in my city, Portland, at that time was to riot for 3 days straight. And that was the first time that I had come face to face with marauding gangs of people dressed in black uniforms with masks, carrying weapons, destroying property, starting fires. And they were doing it in a coordinated fashion. From that point forward, political violence was really becoming routine in Portland and a regular occurrence on the streets of downtown in particular. And the coverage that I saw from my colleagues, as well as those professional journalists in Portland who then set the narrative for the national media, was that they were describing these extremist militants as just anti-fascists who are opposing Nazis and fascists, when I saw that that wasn't the case. The people that they called fascists was anybody who disagreed with them. So for them, they applied that label to regular conservatives and Trump supporters. And so it just became one of my beats at the time to write about what was happening in my city. And then eventually in 2019, I got pulled into the story when during the in the middle of covering one of their protests or riots, Antifa actually had targeted me and beat me severely, a mob of them, and gave me a brain hemorrhage. And ever since then, it's been my mission to really focus on this full time, because it's not just myself that's been victimized. It's been so many other people. And as we see over and over, the mainstream media provides cover and excuses for the violent extremism, even as they continue to escalate in the form of rioting for more than 120 days in Portland, claiming territory in Seattle and elsewhere.
I've followed your coverage of this group for years, and I remember when you were attacked, and I'm glad you're back to covering and writing. We've all seen the pictures, at least the videos, of Antifa in these cities, but how do you define this group? What is it?
It is simultaneously a movement, an ideology, and groups, organizations. So they can be hard to define to the average person or a journalist who doesn't know much about them, because you can actually, the statement that Antifa is not an organization is actually true. There's no single entity. There are multiple organizations. There's Rose City Antifa. There are numerous groups that make up the Torch Network. But what they have in common is, under the banner of what they say is anti-fascism, they espouse a violent extremist, anarchist, communist ideology, and they are actually working to try to destabilize local governments in the United States with the ultimate goal of destroying the U.S. itself. And that may sound outlandish and impossible for them to achieve, but if you just look, what happened in 2020, for more than 3 weeks in a major American city in the Pacific Northwest, near downtown, they actually were given the opportunity to do so when they established CHAZ. And I write about that in the book. I was there for a week undercover. And it was so jarring to see the coverage that was coming out from the mainstream press, as well as the mayor, who was describing it as a summer of love. Other journalists were describing it as a block party. When what I saw happening at night when these journalists left was just descent into pure anarchy, as would happen. And of course, there were multiple homicide shootings that happened. These Antifa militants set up a hard border with checkpoints and actually manned it with armed security. And they did the same thing in December in Portland, when they claimed territory in North Portland for 6 days. So this is a violent extremist movement that people don't recognize as dangerous, because they actually think that a group that calls themselves anti-fascist are anti-fascist when they're not. The tactics they use are, I know this is inflammatory to say, but they're terroristic tactics. And if you look at the literature, that's actually what they advocate for. That is the feature and not a bug in what they actually believe.
You're listening to The Bookmonger, a production of National Review, and this episode is sponsored by Babbel. When I was in college, I struggled with foreign languages. Making the jump from rudimentary knowledge to real competence felt like hitting a brick wall, and I wish I had a tool like Babbel, the number one selling language learning app. Its 15-minute lessons make it the perfect way to learn a new language on the go. The courses are designed with practical conversations in mind. Its speech recognition technology helps you improve your pronunciation and accent. You can pick from 14 different languages, including Spanish, French, Italian, and German. And right now, when you buy a 3-month Babbel subscription, you'll get an additional 3 months for free. That's half a year for the price of 3 months. Go to Babbel.com and use the promo code Bookmonger. Babbel is spelled B-A-B-B-E-L. The code is Bookmonger. Babbel, language for life. Andy, you've gotten to know some of these activists. You've seen them up close. Who joins Antifa, and what motivates them?
There are, broadly speaking, two kinds of Antifa. I think the first category I would call the people who come from privileged backgrounds. And I know this based on looking into the backgrounds of those who have been arrested at many of these riots. We have a pretty decently sized sample size from Portland, because the riots went on for so many months. And these will include people who work in academe, who work in medicine, who have the master's degrees, high education and all that. And these are people who have been marinated completely in the critical race theories that really kind of form part of the one of the legs of Antifa's ideology, that the U.S. is fundamentally racist, that capitalism is linked in a system of white supremacy and racism and oppression. And the other grouping within Antifa, I would say, are people who are struggling with difficulties in life, such as vagrancy, economic issues, mental health issues. And these are people that I have sympathy for, because instead of receiving help in society, they've been drawn into a violent extremist cult and are used often as the henchmen to carry out criminal activities. And on the small chance that they actually do get convicted and sentenced, they're just another drop in the bucket.
What are we supposed to do about this violent radical movement? How can we defeat it?
I think you defeat it primarily by defeating its ideology. The U.S. has such a robust First Amendment that we don't want to chip away at freedom of expression that gives the protections to these extremists to espouse and believe and read the extremist stuff that they do. However, I think the issue is that they've been able to mainstream tenets of their ideology with really no organized pushback and no meaningful pushback. And so hopefully by people reading Unmasked, they can understand the ideology better and be better equipped to counter the underpinning beliefs that are giving Antifa the legitimacy they need to wreak havoc within the mainstream in broad daylight.
Is there also a law enforcement aspect to defeating Antifa?
Absolutely. So the whole systematic attack on law enforcement, not just individual departments that have police that are accused of doing misconduct, but policing as an institution itself in the United States, and by extension, the criminal justice system, that has been very intentional, and that has been to the benefit of Antifa, of course, because in areas where they've been able to thrive, in Portland and Seattle, for example, are areas where officers have been resigning by the droves, where people are taking early retirement, where police departments are getting slashed budget-wise by the tens, hundreds of millions. So there's a law enforcement component to this. And it really, and another thing is also that district attorneys need to actually hold accused criminals accountable. The issue in Portland, for example, and other places are so-called progressive district attorneys who, as a matter of policy, essentially decriminalize left-wing rioting.
The author is Andy Ngo. The book is Unmasked, Inside Antifa's Radical Plan to Destroy Democracy. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this show, please take a minute to leave a review. Your reviews help new listeners discover us, and that helps us keep this show going. We'll be back next week with a new episode of The Bookmonger.